In D.C., 61 degrees under sunny skies. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Channel in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito de Colombia here on this Friday, October 8, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Los Angeles following the passing of baseball legend Fernando Valenzuela and how his impact on LA's Mexican-American community went beyond the baseball diamond. So today on the show, we have the honor and the pleasure of having Gustavo Arellano, who's a columnist for the LA Times, and he has a recent article with regards to the passing of Fernando Valenzuela entitled Why Fernando Valenzuela's Magic Should Ensure Him a Spot in the Hall of Fame. So he joins us for the first time on the show. Welcome to the show, Gustavo Arellano.
Gracias for having me.
Absolutely, man. So this is one of those stories where baseball may have brought us together today in this conversation, but the legend of Fernando Valenzuela and Fernando Mania goes beyond professional sports. And on top of that, the timing of his passing so close to Dia de los Muertos and the start of the World Series, which the Dodgers just won, you know, to use your words, it's quite mythic. And it's also very, very close to his birthday as well. So it's kind of, I would imagine, would be mixed emotions in the Los Angeles area. But I want to begin by your recent article in the LA Times, because the first thing that you said in your article in explaining, you know, his story, his legacy in Los Angeles, is his nickname, El Todo, which was the first thing that came to mind upon Fernando's passing. So I want to start there by asking you, why was that the first thing that came to mind? His nickname, El Toro. You know, there are a lot of ways of commemorating and doing obituaries. We've seen plenty of them in the last couple of weeks. You know, why start there? What's so special there to begin with?
It was his nickname. Everyone knew him as El Toro. Like, you wouldn't even say Fernando, at least in the Mexican-American immigrant community, which, of course, my parents are a part of. You would say, oh, sí, ¿cómo está El Toro? Like, you would never say, ¿cómo está Fernando? You'd say, ¿cómo está El Toro? Oh, mira El Toro. Like, you know, because Fernando was a big golfer, and my late uncle, Miguel Santos, was a big golfer. So he'd say, oh, sí, Toro estaba jugando allá y todo eso. And you know, it's such a great nickname, the Bull. In American English, we usually use that for what? Mobsters and for boxers, mostly on the East Coast, you know? But in Latin America, the decimos también, I thought the same thing, like stocky guy, tough, you know, fighter, more than anything. But, you know, I thought about that, and Fernando was mythic, but he's your classic mythic tragic hero, because he was a hero, but overuse brought him down at the end of his career. I mean, let's be honest. It was sad to see him jump from team to team. This is the guy who dominated LA. He just cut him unceremoniously before the 1991 season started, before he was good again. Guaranteed contract, I think. Like, a couple $1 million just down the drain. And then he just bounced around, and like, that's no way to treat a hero. And then, you know, even in his last couple of decades, he was in the broadcast around the legend. Jaime Javier was hired, but like the Dodgers never asked him to like be a coach. Mexico's national baseball team did, but the Dodgers never did. So I know Mas estaba like he was. So I thought of like, we like the Bulls, but we like Bulls because they like to fight. And if they fight humans, well, they're going to lose. I mean, almost always they're going to lose and they're going to be killed. And their best hope is to basically have their heads stuffed and placed on a plaque, which is a horrible way to think about those things, but that's what we did with Fernando. So I was very, very sad when he passed away. I mean, I think his legacy, of course, speaks for itself, but I just think we could have treated him far, far better. And definitely the Dodgers could have treated him far, far better. And also Major League Baseball. I was one of those people who said he should never be in the Hall of Fame because at the end his career was just average, but just seeing the outpouring of support that people had for him, all the stories, y todo. Like, not just in Los Angeles. Obviously, L.A. was where Fernando Mania happened, but on the East Coast. I was on a radio station in Canada, and the guy was a Montreal Expos fan, which, of course, is now the Washington Nationals. And he was just talking about how, as a kid growing up, like, he loved to see Fernando unless he played the Expos, and he would always beat the Expos. So he's like, you might think that, you know, a Canadian would not have any feelings for Fernando passing away, but no, we respected him as well. So yeah, I just think it's all encapsulated in that nickname, Toro. Like, it's still a strong name, but it's a sad name too.
It's interesting that you mentioned Canada, because I've been trying to do my research on all the obituaries that come out since then. And there are even ones from The Guardian and The Independent in the UK mentioning Fernando, and that doesn't even include Spanish-speaking media outlets, you know, mentioning his passing as well and the legacy of Fernando Mania. And to prove your point that he still had value after the Dodgers left him, we'll mention this later on, but, you know, he certainly had a lot of value in San Diego during his short time there in the mid-90s. And there's a lot to be said there as well that probably people may not realize. But before I get to that, a few years ago, the LA Times did a fantastic documentary on Fernando Mania, which you sort of worked on as well. And like any documentation of Fernando Mania, even at this point, as we do this in Requiem, the shadow of Chavez Ravine and Valenzuela are almost interlinked, for lack of a better term. So it would be naive to say I could summarize everything all at once, but to summarize here, in this conversation, the Dodgers built their stadium on barrios where many residents were forcibly displaced. Up until Fernando's arrival, the Dodgers were shunned, basically, by LA's Latino community. Now, with the passing of Fernando, go ahead.
I think that's a bit of a myth. Now, yes, a sizable group of Mexican-Americans were very upset about what happened in Chavez Ravine. And just to be clear, what happened was that there was three barrios, Bishop, Palo Verde, and La Loma. And There were three barrios right there going back decades. And in the 1950s, the city of Los Angeles went to these people and said, hey, we want to basically modernize your barrios. We're going to build public housing. So please get out. Like, we'll pay for your, you know, we'll do it via eminent domain. So we'll try to give you what's the fair market value. And then you'll be able to come back. Well, that campaign got scuttled because the guy who was running it, I believe it was Francis Wilkerson, he got accused of being a communist because this is during the Red Scare and got driven out. But there was still eminent domain, so families were forcibly evicted. And then basically by the time that the Dodgers were thinking of going to the West Coast, Chavez Ravine, which was what it was later called, or even called back then, just the whole area, the three barrios together, it was seen as a perfect spot for a baseball stadium. And the city of L.A. basically offered it to the Dodgers for free. And there were still some families there. They got evicted. And so, yes, it was a big outrage to the Mexican-American community that was there. But after the 1960s, you start getting thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of Mexican-Americans coming in who knew nothing about this history. My uncles and my dad, when they came to the United States or they were cheering for the Dodgers, they had no idea about Chavez Ravine. They were cheering for Steve Garvey. They were cheering for Don Sutton. They were cheering for Ron Say, Davey Lopes, Dusty Baker. So the idea that somehow they were completely shunned, I mean, I need to start pushing back against that because that's just not historically true. But this is the important thing. This is where it does tie into Fernando. Fernando coming in, for a lot of Mexican-Americans who did have resentment against the Dodgers because of the sin of Chavez Ravine, they started coming back. These Mexican immigrants who had no idea about Chavez Ravine, but they wanted to root for a winner, that's when they started going to the stadium. Look, if Fernando Valenzuela had an average rookie season, if he was just a pitcher, because the Dodgers had had Mexican-American pitchers before. They had had Latino players before, but they were whatever. It was the fact that it was Fernando. And he was so amazing that brought people in. And that's when reporters and activists started talking about Chavez Ravine. So you are right in saying that it is inextricable, Chavez Ravine and Fernando Valenzuela, but not in the way that people usually think.
Yeah, the last time I spoke to you, almost 2 years ago, I mentioned that Chavez Ravine is a history in and of itself and an hour-long conversation in and of itself that still deserves a more nuanced understanding with regards not just to sports here, but also to the issue of gentrification, identity, yeah, whether it be a community or the city itself. And so now in hindsight, with the passing of Fernando, I'm having a hard time with those two subjects now, because is it fair to say closure? Can we say that this chapter has ended? What's the right word to crystallize sort of the end of these two stories that have been going, swirling parallel to each other for so long?
Fernando, may he rest in peace. He has left. His body has left us, but his spirit, Jesus ejemplos, his examples, will never leave us. The Dodgers have been such a great franchise, next to the Yankees, frankly, in remembering its history, in documenting its history. But they refuse to have to do anything with what happened in Chavez Ravine. There has been pushes for restitution. There has been pushes for a monument. The Dodgers will not do any of that. They argue that they have nothing to do with it. Like, the families were displaced before the Dodgers came into town, which is technically not true. The Arechigas, which is one of the last families that were in Chavez Ravine, they were still there. I think they got kicked out 58, 59. The Dodgers were already, you know, ready to go into town, if not already playing at the Coliseum. So are the Dodgers culpable of what happened with the families? No. Did they benefit from that? Absolutely. They got that land. They got that land. Otherwise, they would have been at the Coliseum. All they have to do, I mean, and they have hosted the so-called Desterrados. The Desterrados is a group of families who, either individuals who were born in Chavez Ravine or now mostly their descendants. Oh, yeah. Los Desterrados, they have a yearly picnic. 1 year, the Dodgers, I think, acknowledged them before a game. So that's cool. But have a plaque. I mean, you are literally built on Chavez Ravine. At the very least, you could have an interactive exhibit in this day and age where so many sectors of society are reckoning with our past, which is not perfect by any sense of the imagination, but at least if you reckon with it and acknowledge it and document it, I think that's just such a powerful thing. And the Dodgers just refuse to do that. And that's the thing. The people who are pushing for something like that, They're a tiny, tiny minority. A lot of Latino fans do know about Chavez Ravine, but they're like, well, that's a pass. Yay, go Dodgers. Dodgers won in 5 games and move on. So that's a whole other conversation.
Yes, it is. Because while the case of Chavez Ravine may have gone almost all these decades later, the issue that underlies it, which is gentrification, lack of affordable housing, is, for lack of a better term, still universal to anyone, not just in Los Angeles, not just in California, but everywhere. And so it reiterates again that this story, baseball may have brought us here today, but this goes beyond just baseball itself. And so sticking to the Dodgers themselves as an organization, what are your thoughts of the whole tributes and their response to the passing of Fernando, especially since it happened almost on the eve of the first game of the World Series against the Yankees, who Fernando beat back in 1981? Mm-hmm. Again, there are so many things happening here that parallel one another that I don't want to use the term divine intervention, but it's just a confluence of coincidences that
cannot be
ignored.
No, you can't ignore these. I mean, look, like the coincidences are all over. Miguel Santos, may he rest in peace. He shared the same birthday as Fernando, which he was such a huge, huge, huge Dodgers fan. One of his prized possessions was a golf cap that Fernando signed for him, because as I said earlier, Miguel Santos was an avid golfer and so was Fernando. So he would see Fernando on the golf links in Montebello, City of Industry, all of those areas. You know, the Dodgers got a lot of controversy also for not retiring Fernando's number until last year. They had a whole weekend for him, but still, like, you know, they would sell jerseys, bienque. They'd make a bunch of money off of Fernando with jerseys, with bobbleheads, with all sorts of other memorabilia. But this time around, I think they did as good as they could do. Look, Fernando was a very private person. People knew something was wrong with him because he was getting skinnier and his skin was getting darker. But the Dodgers never speculated. Even reporters, responsible reporters, never speculated because they knew Fernando's, you know, they kept Fernando's wishes, which is like, just leave him alone, let him do his own thing. Even when Fernando finally stepped back from his duties about a month before he passed away, so this came really, really quick, the Dodgers just said, you know, he's going to focus on his health. And they didn't say he was retiring. They just said he's stepping back. Then, of course, game one of the World Series. I mean, look, and the playoffs are going and they're winning and Fernando's not passing away. Then during the break between the Dodgers beating the Mets and game one, which was on a Friday, and Fernando passed away, the Dodgers, they immediately did the tribute. All the players had the number 34 on their jersey. And then they had Oral Hershiser and Steve Yeager, who are former teammates of Fernando. They wore his Valenzuela's jersey. Instead of throwing out the first pitch, they went to the mound where there was a 34 of Fernando there. They just put two baseballs there. So it was amazing. I was not there at the stadium to see if they did anything else. I was also driving to my house to be able to see the game, so I didn't see that initial tribute. But I'm hoping that they also ran like a video tribute to his career, because heaven knows Fernando deserved it.
Yeah, they certainly did. And they play a lot of Mexican music as well. You know, some soft.
Juan Gabriel I saw on Twitter.
Exactly. So that was a nice touch, to say the least that they could do. Now, I want to go back to what I mentioned earlier, which is this fantastic documentary that you did in 2021 with regards to Fernando Mania for the LA Times. And people can go to YouTube and still watch it. It is a fantastic documentary, and I recommend everyone to watch it. What I find interesting about that documentary, looking back on it now, is that obviously you can have sports reporters and people that, you know, focus solely on that field in explaining the phenomenon of Fernando Mania during that time. But you also had an equal number of artists, writers, poets, playwrights, people like that drawing that sort of artistic inspiration from Fernando Mania during that very interesting time period in the early 80s in Los Angeles within the Mexican-American community. And I've always wanted to ask you, were you surprised almost how you had this equal number of artists along with sports writers when creating this documentary? Because I always found that fascinating, how so many people draw artistic inspiration from Fernando.
I was just a narrator, so I just read the script. All credit goes to Eric Himmelsbach, who is no longer with the LA Times, unfortunately, and Mark Potts, who still is. They were the one, and Steve Saldivar, who, again, sadly, is not with the LA Times anymore. They were the creative brains behind that. And they immediately knew, like, oh, we have to get Gustavo to narrate this because I, you know, I'm a huge Fernando fan and sports fan and all of that. I did tweak the script to my voice, but that's it. The people who they saw, that was them. And it was brilliant. It was frankly brilliant because Fernando was not just about sports. Fernando was about culture. Fernando was about politics. You had Edward James Olmos. You had Danny Trejo. You had Richard Montoya from Culture Clash. My big wow moment was seeing the late legendary LA County Supervisor Gloria Molina. Everyone had their Fernando story. Everyone. Like, it was so incredible just to see all of this. And thank you for saying the nice words about Fernando Mania at 40, because it is a great documentary. We won a local Emmy for it. That's how great it was. And even if we did it, it'd still be a great documentary. And we also did a Spanish language version as well, a little bit shortened, but we still did it. But I think we hit that point perfectly, that Fernando was a cultural phenomenon that everyone wanted. The most prominent part, sure, was the Mexican-American fan base and Latino fan base nationwide. I just got so proud, but everyone wanted to be a part of Fernando, musicians and movie makers and just so much. It was an honor to be a part of that.
Absolutely. And again, I encourage everyone to not only watch it, but we're going to create a link on our Twitter account to that documentary so people can watch it. It is such a fascinating story, and you don't have to be a baseball fan either to watch it as well. Now, let's talk about the aesthetic of Fernando himself, Fernando Mania. Anyone who Googles images of Fernando in the last few days will see an equal number of murals along with his obituaries. And we all know the image of Fernando, a heavyset Mexican guy holding court in the major leagues in a way that hasn't been seen since, in my opinion. There's a lot of theories to this sort of admiration and this sort of drawing some artistic inspiration from the aesthetic of Fernando, the individual himself. I have my theory to see if I could run this by you, but oftentimes professional sports can be a form of escapism, an escape from the everyday. And Fernando, looking at it now in hindsight, Fernando sort of represented the everyday man in LA's Mexican-American community. So I sort of reached the conclusion that Fernando Mania and Fernando the individual turned into a celebration of the everyday. And so that's sort of the conclusion that I drew as to why people loved him so much. There are many other reasons, but I think that's one component that doesn't get mentioned often enough.
I agree with you. Look, I mean, the reason why, again, I cannot reiterate this. The reason why Fernando took off the way he did was because he was a winner. And not just a winner, he was an extraordinary winner. That's what Fernando Mania was about. You opened the 1981 season with 8 straight wins, a bunch of shutouts, a bunch of complete games. He was absolutely incredible. Won the Cy Young and Rookie of the Year award, helped the Dodgers get into the World Series and helped them win the World Series. But yeah, the yeoman's approach to this. He looked like a Mexicano, not to stereotype, pero estaba prieto, estaba gordito. He had the big bushy hair that was in use in the 1980s, and it was jet black. Se miraba como indio. And I say this with all respect. Se miraba como campesino. In Major League Baseball, they always, you know, there's always sort of added admiration for players who are, to put it lightly, portly, a little bit bigger than usual. So your Babe Ruth, your David Wells, your Cecil Fielders, your, who was the other one I was just thinking of right now? You know, like Charlie Huff, the old knuckleballer, like bigger guys. Because you're like, you know, you think of baseball players, you're thinking of a Ken Griffey Jr., a Mike Trout, you know, Aaron Judge, a Juan Soto, men who are tall, muscular, all of that. You do not think of the bigger guys. And then when they win, you're going to say something. Go for it.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, somebody in the documentary said that you look at him at first glance and you think, he's not going to win.
Yeah, he's not going to win because he's the Mexican. You look at him like, oh, that's your typical Mexican. And then he's just mowing down people like the legends, like the people who do not look like him, you know? And that's what endeared him so much. And that's the Fernando that, yeah, all these murals, you know, on this past Sunday I went to a mural unveiling at a five-story apartment building in Boyle Heights, right off the 101 freeway. It's going to be a triptych, so it's going to be three murals, all with separate scenes, not connected, but it's basically Fernando doing su lanzamiento, his delivery, his wind-up and all of that. And it's just so incredible. L.A., the world capital of murals, and here's this amazing mural. The cool thing is it's on First Street, and you take all the First Street across the L.A. River. It goes into Little Tokyo.
40 years later, and say to ourselves, that could never happen today. And so, for example, anyone who Googles images of Fernando, especially during his time in the 1980s, perhaps one picture that people will stumble upon is him with Ronald Reagan. Now, considering the political climate that we see in recent times, again, that is something that would never happen today. But it did happen, you know, considering all the issues of immigration, all that stuff. Again, this goes beyond just a baseball diamond, but it gives you an idea of how far-reaching his popularity was. That, again, this immigrant guy and the aesthetics, again, there's that word again, aesthetics. It's sort of incongruous to think that that would ever happen in modern times.
We don't know if Trump has invited people. We do know he has invited teams and some have gone, but the majority have not. Like, you know, big example, the Golden State Warriors have repeatedly rejected any idea of even going to the White House. But with Reagan, I mean, that was the magic of Fernando, that when you had the Mexican ambassador to the, or I believe it was the Mexican president who came into the White House, Reagan wanted to meet Fernando for himself. And in the Fernando Mania documentary, we talk about how Reagan, that meeting with Fernando, I don't want to say softened Reagan's views on Mexicans, but it probably did. Because again, you see someone like, this is what Mexico could bring. Why would you not want to legalize all these undocumented people? Not just Mexicans, of course, but of all, you know, of all nationalities and all of that. So, but everyone wanted to have a piece of Fernando, whether he was playing or in retirement, everyone did.
Certainly, certainly. And going back to your documentary once again, like we said before, he was released in 1991. And one component in that documentary that really caught my attention was this one part. And you actually pulled an article out of this during the documentary, is that there are Latino organizations that actually tried to boycott the Dodgers when they released him in 91. And that usually doesn't happen. Again, this is professional sports. This is, again, in a lot of ways, a form of escapism. But the idea of grassroots organizations trying to create a boycott, even though, as we said before, he was declining in the last few years with Los Angeles, is quite telling to how strong, you know, the Latino community is in Los Angeles. You know, we have a Latino, obviously, here in Washington, but certainly not as big or as influential as that in Los Angeles. And so I just bring it up to you because it still catches my attention. Like, really, that big a community would have that strong a reaction at that time?
And that was 1991. Imagine today where, I mean, you saw the parade on television. The crowd was 85% Latino, more probably. Like, if you go to Dodger Stadium, tickets are expensive. You go to Dodger Stadium, that's going to be probably majority Latino, like 50% or so. Both the parade and then the gathering at Dodger Stadium, that was overwhelmingly Latino because that is the Dodgers fan base nowadays. If the fan base decided, hey, we're going to stage a boycott, we're not going to go to games until Fernando, or at least until Chavez Ravine is acknowledged, that would happen easily. Overnight, the Dodgers would say, like, shoot, we got to do this, and I stop. But sadly, the Dodgers fan base, like, because it's sports. Yeah, sports, people, as you've said, sports is a form of escapism. People do not really want to think about politics. Right now, you know, while we're recording this, it's Monday night, so I was watching Monday Night Football. Then I get hit with an ad for Kamala Harris on the day before Election Day, and then an ad for Donald Trump on the day before Election Day. And so I tweeted, I'm like, I don't want to be hit with political commercials while I'm watching Monday Night Football. I'm sorry. And obviously, there's one commercial that I thought that was better than the other. And guess what? It wasn't Donald Trump's commercial. But, like, I do not need politics in my sports. But sometimes there's going to be franchises who do bad things. And It's up to the fan base to decide how they're going to punish them. But like, sports owners are not going to listen to outside forces, but they will listen to their fans, and specifically the fans who are going to the ballpark. Because if they choose not to go, well, then what do you have to sell, you know?
Yeah, and I'll take it a step further, because I've always made the argument that capitalist structures, whether it be professional sports or otherwise, are not agents for social change. And it's one of those moments where sports and politics do collide in a positive way to a certain degree, as far as raising awareness to this dark history that we mentioned earlier with Chavez Ravine. Obviously, that in and of itself needs a more nuanced conversation, a more nuanced understanding of why it's still relevant today. But that's one of those moments where, okay, I understand what you're saying. And I agree to you to a very large degree as well in your analysis. Now, to the issue of the Hall of Fame, because you mentioned this in your article, in your recent article as well, I've never really understood how the Hall of Fame works. It's sort of like Kabuki theater as to who gets in, who gets out. Obviously, stats, facts, and figures like that are important. But at the same time, there are a lot of rotten human beings who are in the Hall of Fame nonetheless. And Fernando's not there. In my opinion, he should have been there. Not so much for the stats, but for the cultural influence that he had on the city, on the community. You were sort of, and based on what I read in your article, was sort of still on the fence as to whether or not he should be there. But at the end, what conclusion did you make?
Oh, no, I was not on the fence at all. I was very much of the mindset that Fernando did not belong in the Hall of Fame, because for me, the Hall of Fame is about numbers. What was your contribution on the field? And Fernando was better than average, but he was not among the greats. And that's just how it was. But again, as I put in my article, once I saw the outpouring of grief and love for Fernando, and I realized it wasn't about the numbers. It wasn't even about, and then the other big thing. So what you said about the cultural impact, for me, it was just too transactional. Like, oh, Fernando brought more Latino ball players to the park. It's like, oh, so you want him in the Hall of Fame because he basically made the Dodgers rich. Yeah, we're talking about capitalism here. That's not an argument for me. Frankly, that's scary to see a franchise basically exploit a Mexican. That's what they did. They exploited a Mexican, then they tossed him. So for me, at the end, it was about the magic. Like, that's what it, like, it hit me. Maybe I just, you know, in the Baseball Hall of Fame, they could elect whoever they want. They could elect the worst player, because it's basically a certain amount of sports writers, not all of them, who get a ballot. In recent years, a lot of them are posting. It used to be secret. It's not really secret that much anymore. Some of them post it on social media. There's also a veterans committee. A veterans committee, they decide of players who maybe have been overlooked. And they just released the latest batch, and Fernando's name is not on it, which is a damn shame, because at the end, what I realized is it's that magic. Baseball, among all the professional sports in the United States, the major ones at least, has that capability to have players that capture the imagination. And look, you see that sometimes in football, basketball, you have LeBron, you have Jordan, but Magic, but not like baseball. These are transformational figures. We're talking about Babe Ruth. We're talking about a Ken Griffey Jr., an Ichiro, a Shohei, and Fernando was part of that. And then on top of that, you add all the other cultural components and everything, and then just the tragedy of his career. But look, I mean, the Hall of Fame is so cruel. Like Thurman Munson, who was a great New York Yankee, he's not in the Hall of Fame because he died in a plane crash early. He would have made it into the Hall of Fame, but he's never made it into the Hall of Fame because of that. And Thurman Munson was great, but he did not have that magic the way Fernando did. So that's why I now am a very proud advocate of getting Fernando into the Hall of Fame. This is not affirmative action. Not that there's anything wrong with affirmative action, but this is just really looking at, you know, what are the intangibles of baseball? Not always about stats. Sometimes it's that extra something, you know? And Fernando was very much that extra something.
Yeah, it's interesting that we've gone this far into the conversation and not mention, I'm going to mess up the pronunciation, but Echeuquila.
Echeuquila, I know you got it.
Echeuquila, Mexico. And it's virtually in the middle of nowhere. It's in Sonora, but it's a small town, nondescript. 40 years later, it's still a small town, nondescript. And you could call me romantic in discussing this component of his story, but it is, to me, an amazing immigrant story as well. probably more so than it is a baseball story, considering the odds so much stacked against him in a place where there's very little opportunity, very little chance of going to as far as he did. And yet somehow he did it nonetheless in reaching the heights of Major League Baseball. And that's a component I think we have to address here when it comes to the Mexican-American community. It shows that, hey, again, I'm trying not to romanticize this too much, but again, this is an immigrant story. Look where he came from and look where he ended up in Los Angeles.
Your classic rags to riches American dream story, or even Mexican dream story. Yeah, Hecho Huaquila is just going to be your rancho, a tiny little rancho near the city of Navajoa in Sonora. Sonora, a huge state, northern Mexico, very much farming country and all of that. His dad was a cat, you know, raised cattle, but not a, like a big rich person. One of eight sons out of a family of 12. And Fernando was the one who was able to make it into the... They all played baseball, but he's just the one who had the talent. He was the one who just happened to be pitching a great game when the legendary Dodger scout Mike Brito saw him, told the Dodgers to sign him, and then he was able to, you know, go... Where was it? In San Antonio, he pitched in the minors. Just went through his entire, you know, minor league career until he finally lands with the Dodgers in the end of 1980, impresses people immediately, comes back in 81, and the rest, of course, is Fernando Mania. Again, and this is who Mexico brings to this country. Not what Donald Trump says, a bunch of rapists and drug dealers, but people like Fernando, people who come from nothing. Now you have these alt losers saying that, well, we only have to bring the most talented people. No. Bring on the so-called, you know, the wretched, give me your poor, your wretched, Emma Lazarus wrote on the Colossus, that is the Statue of Liberty. My dad came here with a fourth grade education. You want those people who are hungry, because those are the people who succeed. The people who already succeeded in their homelands and then come here to the United States, they're not going to add anything other than a tax base. Who the hell cares about a tax base to the United States? We want dreamers. We want strivers. We want Fernando Valenzuelas.
Absolutely. And this immigrant story is also cross-generational in a certain way, because ESPN did a documentary on Fernando Mania several years ago, and they actually had footage of his mom and dad, Fernando's mom and dad. And I looked at that footage and, like, they kind of remind me of my aunts and uncles, you know, when I saw them. And as a matter of fact, Fernando, I'll tell you this right now, my dad had a spitting image of Fernando, you know what I'm saying, in a variety of ways. And so in his last few years, when he started to get sick and you could visibly see him getting sick, it really moved me, because I saw my dad getting sick and sort of changing physically almost in the same way as Fernando. And so the last few years, for anyone who's a fan of his legacy and the impact that he had in the community of Los Angeles, you know, the last few years were kind of tough, but you could see it coming, unfortunately. It's sort of seeing like a relative that you care about, you know, going through this time. You dread the inevitable, but you know it's coming. And now that it's happened with, again, like I said earlier, this confluence of Dia de los Muertos, his birthday, the start of the World Series, playing against the Yankees of all people, it's sort of very chilling, to say the least. And so there should be murals of Fernando. There should be statues of Fernando. There should be, you know, maybe a stadium or maybe a school named after him. Whatever it is, the fact that this sort of phenomenon, this sports phenomenon, went beyond sports itself is sort of amazing and speaks a lot to the man himself. So, Gustavo, we have about 5 minutes left, and I want to reiterate again that we're going to create a link to that Fernando Mania documentary on our Twitter account so people can check it out, because it's more than just a sports story here. But in a few minutes that we have left, what else can we take stock of with regards to this legacy and how it still, you know, moves people even today after all these years?
Above all that, for one magical year, everyone in Los Angeles, a very anti-Latino city back then and in the before then and today, everyone wanted to be a Mexican. How often can we say that in American culture, that anyone wants to be a Mexican? Mexicans have always been spat upon in American culture, ridiculed, we're buffoons, we're gang members, we're spicy señoritas, we're all of that stuff. We're rarely heroes. We're rarely heroes. We, you know, when we talk about representation, our stories, our heroic stories are rarely told. I mean, we get Flaming Hot Cheetos for crying out loud. Like, that's who we're supposed to be cheering on. That's just disgusting. And, you know, I got in a lot of trouble for both, or rather, right, my colleague Sam Dean wrote a story that brought out the fact that Richard Montañez, who's been going on forever saying that he invented Flaming Hot Cheetos. No, there was already a product like Flaming Hot Cheetos that was in development or Fatal Lake when he says he did it. And so I criticized the film as being pernicious. And I got so much crap for it that people say, oh, no, we got to support one of our own. You want to support someone who alleges, who claims that he invented a product that's basically food coloring and like empty calories? No, that's not who we should be aspiring to be. We should be aspiring to be Fernando. And in 1981, it wasn't just Latinos who wanted to be Fernando. It was everyone. You had the entire generation of young boys in Los Angeles. And of course, sadly, this was an era where sexism was still rampant. So a couple of young girls, but mostly young boys, were being told by their elders, you know, do the whole Fernando lineup, make it happen. Like, you too can be Fernando. And it was boys of all races, not just Mexicans. That's, I think, the most powerful thing about Fernando was, again, if he was just a Mexican who joined the Dodgers, yeah, people would be like, that's cool. No, he was a winner. And not just was he a winner, he was the best of the best. That's what he exemplified. He exemplified what we Mexicans are capable of doing. And he not just exemplified it, but he made it happen. And so we were able to imagine a world where Mexicans are not just respected, but loved. And wow, what an amazing feeling that was for so many people. And it's one that sadly very few of us have ever been able to experience since, but we can always continue to push and we can always continue to hope.
Yes, because those sort of things may not come very often, may not even happen again, this sort of phenomenon. So quite a chilling story, but a story worth telling and worth remembering. So with that said, we've been speaking with Gustavo Arellano, who's a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. His recent article is entitled Why Fernando Valenzuela's Magic Should Ensure Him a Spot in the Hall of Fame. So it's been a long time coming. I've been dying to have you on the show for some time, and this is well worth it. Thank you very much for your insight and for your just overall information here. I really appreciate it. Thank you for being on the show with us, Gustavo Arellano.
No, gracias so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. That is @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao. We'll be right back.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, November 8th. Here are some headlines. Nearly 70% of the verified fatalities in Gaza as a result of the Israel-Hamas war are women and children, according to a new report published today by the UN Human Rights Office. The report examined fatalities that occurred over the six-month period between November 2023 and April 2024 and includes only fatalities that were confirmed by at least three independent sources. Nearly 80% of the fatalities occurred in residential buildings. In a press release, the UN Human Rights Office said the report's findings indicate a, quote, systematic violation of the fundamental principles of international humanitarian law, close quote. Volker Turk, the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, called for a due reckoning via impartial judicial bodies over the alleged violations of international law during the war. In domestic news, the party that will control the House of Representatives for the next 2 years is still not decided, but Republicans appear to be inching towards a majority that would hand them full control of the U.S. government. As of this morning, the GOP was 7 seats short of the 218 needed to take control of the House, which means they will be more empowered to push through Donald Trump's agenda, including tax cuts and border control measures. 24 races still remain too close to call. Final tallies will take a while, likely pushing the decision into next week or beyond. The FBI is investigating racist text messages sent to dozens of black people with references to slave catchers and picking cotton. It was not immediately clear who sent the messages, and there is no complete list of whom they were delivered to. Reports of these messages from anonymous phone numbers have surfaced in states including New York, Alabama, California, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee. High school and college students were reportedly among the recipients. The Federal Communications Commission said in a statement it is looking into the racist texts together with federal and state law enforcement. And a federal judge yesterday struck down a Biden administration policy that aimed to ease a path to citizenship for undocumented spouses of U.S. citizens. The program called Keeping Families Together would have provided temporary relief from deportation for about 500,000 undocumented spouses and stepchildren of U.S. citizens through a process known as parole in place. The ruling is a major defeat for the outgoing Biden administration, which argued the policy promoted family unity among mixed-status households. The administration announced the program in June, but a coalition of 16 Republican-led states, led by Texas, quickly filed a lawsuit after applications were made available in August. The Justice Department can appeal yesterday's ruling, but the program is likely to be in the crosshairs of the incoming administration of Donald Trump, who has vowed to dismantle President Biden's immigration policies. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 72 degrees and sunny, with a high of 62 degrees forecast for tomorrow.